The poet A.A. Milne has written, "Halfway down the stairs is the stair where I sit. There isn't any other stair quite like it. I'm not at the bottom, I'm not at the top, so this is the stair where I always stop." Do you realize that wherever you stop may well be a place where the touch of destiny will find you? The portion of Luke that's usually read on Christmas Eve is the part about the decree from Caesar Augustus and the travels of Mary and Joseph and the waiting shepherds and the open heavens and the song of angels. This is part of Luke's prologue, chapters 1 and 2, written late, as Luke was written, because people were finally asking, where does this Jesus figure come from? Tell us more about who he is deeply in the mystery of things. And so Luke wrote chapters 1 and 2 and stuck them on the front. If you went to chapter 3, you will see his gospel begins where the others begin, with the call of John the Baptist. So what Luke has written is basically an overture, as Dr. Fred Craddock calls it. You will hear in chapters 1 and 2 every great theme that you'll hear in the rest of the gospel when you read it. But this passage is just slightly more obscure than the shepherds and the angels, isn't it? We find Jesus as a young man now. He has reached the age of bar mitzvah to become a child of the law, and his family go every year to Jerusalem to Passover to mark the great rescue, the great tribal story of their people. God heard them in their enslavement, and God rescued them from it, the great story of intervention and rescue. And this year, Jesus is among them. And as they leave the city, thinking he is with them, they realize one day's ride out that he is not. And they circle back and search everywhere and see him sitting among the elders and the scribes and the wise of his tribe. And this is the moment of destiny. In chapter 3, you will find him at the age of 30, and he will meet John the Baptist, the one who will launch him into a ministry in outer space. But that's for another day. This is about a sheer moment of inspiration when everyone is simply waiting to see what happens. Having two or three days on my own recently, I was looking across Facebook, doesn't everybody? And I was looking at some of the videos that are on there, doesn't everybody? And one of them was the procession for Christmas at Westminster Abbey. Now, I love processions, and I think when the procession stops, I can probably go home because I just like the procession part most of all. But I watched with great interest as the choir came down and then the dean came down alone. And as you looked closely, he was carrying in his arms the figure of the baby Jesus. And he stopped at the crossing where there was a manger laid out with straw and some of the other figures of the traditional manger scene. The crossing before they go under the rood screen and up into the chancel where the choir sits and where the priests minister. It's the crossing place between the sacred part and the part where the people sit, the place where you'll always meet the baby Jesus. And the dean stands there for a few moments, and then there is silence, and then very quietly he lays the baby Jesus into the manger. And then he stands back and waits in the silence of expectation. And then they sense the thing with the incense. And then after an appropriate amount of time, and Jesus is laid in the manger, and we all wait to see what it's going to mean in this season, they go round the crossing and up through the choir to begin the rest of the service. A very moving thing, a moment of waiting, sitting among the prophets and the scribes in infancy, waiting to see what's going to happen. And the artistry of St. Luke comes through in his stories. The church chose fabulous writers to tell of their faith in Jesus Christ. In the story, old meets new. Wisdom embraces young brilliance. The old war veterans sitting at K-Wing at Sunnybrook Hospital are suddenly seen talking to groups of school children, telling them what it's like to weep and to laugh, to be in profound strangeness and violence and to come home to the rest of the world. And the children are listening with open ears and open hearts. We see it every day. And the stage set, which St. Luke paints for us, is the familiar one. The threats of all the pharaohs and the emperors, which are always oppressing the people, and then the regression and repression of enslavement. The people would know that every day with the Romans marching in their street. And then the cost of courage, which will come along later in the gospel in the story of the cross. And then the gift of rescue, this rescue out of slavery, which will come in the experience of the resurrection. And then the life we're all living now by faith, a life lived on the way to promised land. That's where we are, says the gospel writer. There comes a time when the rocket is released from the launch pad. The countdown has finally ended. The cables break free. The rocket lifts off. And Jesus Christ, the Redeemer of the world, is in the air. It is then that all the artistry and the chemistry and the visioning and the planning and the praying come together and we have liftoff. We have a touch of destiny in flight. Well, what if this touch of destiny is not simply a literary device? I believe in a touch of destiny, by the way. I believe it's an ingredient in our lives that perhaps we fail to recognize as often as we might. A touch of destiny where a door suddenly opens and it becomes a watershed mark in our experience. Indeed, what if the touch of destiny is a prime ingredient in redeeming the human adventures? That we are more than generations simply rolling along without particular meaning. That we are more than biological units speaking, rising, falling, dying. What if it is about moments of awakening? Crystal clear moments when suddenly it's your turn and you know it. When you were a child, did you have a magnifying glass on a sunny day and take an old piece of newspaper? And when you focused the magnifying glass just right, the sun came down to a brilliant point. And in a few moments, as you watched with fascination, the paper began to blacken and then it began to smoke and then it burst into flame. A moment of delight. My son David and his partner were in Algeria recently, and they brought me back a Christmas gift. It's a jalaba. A jalaba is the Algerian long robe that's worn with the hood. I looked like Obi-Wan Kenobi when I put it on. And I used to have a jalaba years ago when I was a lot younger, and I wore the thing so often I wore it absolutely threadbare. It was my very favorite garment. So I slipped this one on, and I became someone else. Standing there in that jalaba, I became Obi-Wan Kenobi. Help me, Obi-Wan. Strike me down, Darth, and I shall rise up more powerful than you realize. And I thought to myself, maybe it's time to change apparel. I thought to myself, this part of my life journey is ending soon. Three more Sundays in which to preach in this congregation, and then something else. So when my wife was away, I began to take pictures down off familiar walls. My degrees, put them in the cupboard. My membership in the 78th Fraser Highlanders, in the cupboard. Pictures of my grandparents and my father when he was a baby, took it down, put it in the cupboard. Put up new pictures that didn't have a lot of meaning to me yet, but maybe one day they will, so that when I sit in that room, it will be a different room. And perhaps I'll put on a different robe if I have the courage. I will no longer be going as a United Church of Canada minister into a United Church of Canada congregation to be one of their regular preachers. From now on, by the grace of God, maybe by a touch of destiny, I shall become Obi-Wan Kenobi in my jalaba and arrive and do what happens in those moments and then slip away. And people will say, "What was that?" And some will say, "Not much." And others will say, "You may be surprised. It seems like a change to me." So what if each of us is living out of our touch of destiny? What if all the bits and pieces and the memories and the certainties and the doubts are all coming together in specific moments that will change everything. Do you think that's possible? We are miracles of meaning. We are conduits of amazing grace. When I was in the hospital a few years ago and people were working on my heart, I turned to the door and in walked my minister friend, Dr. Peter Holmes from Yorkminster Park Baptist Church, just sliding in the door for a moment to say hello. "I just came to see that you're all right," he said, and stood there a moment, shook my hand. I thanked him and he left. And I've never forgotten that moment, just that simple little moment, because he was more than Peter Holmes, more than my friend. He was a conduit of grace in human form that just walked into the room and said and did and was the right thing in those moments which turned from worry and concern to a sense of hope. But people can get in the way of us, can't they, sometimes when you want to feel this way? The ones who love us and cherish us, the ones who warn us and chastise us can also hem us in. They can say to us since childhood, "Don't dream too big. Don't think too widely. Don't step out of place. No one likes the exceptional person. They irritate us one by one." And our own experiences may get in the way. We get hurt and bumped and bruised as we live. Friends and strangers let us down. Wounds go deep. Somebody leaves us. Somebody dies. All of us are functioning at less than full capacity because of the things that have happened to us all our years. We would become walking marvels in other people's eyes if others knew the depth of our bravery and the things we have overcome. "You should have seen us in our wreckage," we would say. "But now, by God's grace, behold us in these moments of our beauty." Some of you would have known Gilles Boudreau, who was a member here a long time ago. He is now very sadly deceased. Gilles was a very flamboyant French-Canadian with much elan. He had polio at the age of 6 and had one arm that functioned. The rest of him was in a very small body, and he lived in an electric wheelchair. He lived for 18 years at the Bloor View Children's Hospital. His family rarely visited him. And when he became 18 and could no longer stay there, he signed himself into a First Nations reservation in Northern Ontario, where he'd never been before. And over a series of a few years, as they carried him back into the woods and included them in life, they wanted to name him Chief there. And then he came out and he studied and he worked at Seton House, one of the most difficult places in Toronto to work. He worked there as a counselor and he pulled no punches. He told me one day a big burly man came into him and sat and told his story and slobbered all over him. And Gilles said, "Do you know what you are? You're a loser." The man said, "You can't speak to me like that." "Well, I just did. You're a loser. Look at you. You don't want to change your life. Why are you coming and sitting in front of me?" And the man said, "What time do you get off work? I'll be seeing you outside when you get off work." And there's Gilles, able to move one arm, sitting in an electric wheelchair, he himself weighing about 80 pounds, said, "I get off at 5 o'clock. I'll see you out there." And when 5 o'clock came, Gilles wheeled his way out, and the man was nowhere to be seen. Gilles Boudreau used to talk to God a lot, used to argue with the church a lot. He was so effusive and so bright, you could never get a word in edgewise, and you didn't want to. He is someone whom I could never have imagined from far away, the man he really was close up inside. A walking marvel, and so too are we. We may feel transitory in a scene that seems unending. We may feel we're dust in the wind. We may feel we make no difference. We may say, "Mind your own business, mend your own fences, pray that the threats and storms don't come your way. We're all just passing through anyway," we might be saying to ourselves in this age where the touch of destiny seems so distant from us. In writing to the church at Colossae, Paul writes about our true state, and in so doing, he is a coach for us in the dressing room. "Remember the dream," he says. Remember all those plays we laid out on the chalkboard, he says. Carry them in your mind. Remember the first day you made the team. Remember the first practice and you got bumped around a bit because you didn't know how to do the moves. Remember getting your jersey number, being part of us? Wasn't that really something? And the first hard hit you took, and the first victory you tasted, the first moments of the launch. Do you remember moments like that? When I went to high school, I was a pretty shy kid. Indeed, I'm still a pretty shy kid. And I went in grade 10 and watched the High School Musical. Sitting in the dark, my heart sang, and I knew that's what I wanted to do. So in grade 11, I went to the auditions, my knees knocking together, and they said to me, "Can you sing 'I Get a Kick Out of You'?" I said, "I guess so." So they played in the piano. "I get no kick from champagne." And on it went, and then we were finished, and I don't remember hearing the piano, but I remember that everybody was cheering, and I remember they gave me the lead. And I remember that I was in the theater throughout high school for the rest of the time. A moment of sudden change that just came and stayed. The other day I got a note from Chapter 2, is that the name of the group, at Ryerson, for old people who want to act. They said, "We're having an open house next Tuesday. Would you like to come?" Well, I'm not sure about that yet. The knee's still knocked together. But it seemed like a pretty good idea. There's something in the DNA. I might find myself wandering up there. "Remember the sense of the team," says the coach. "Say to each other, we are part of something way beyond ourselves." I was thinking the other day, looking at that Obi-Wan Kenobi photo on Facebook, that this is a bit strange, that we in the United Church of Canada may be slightly overly familiar. I think you can be overly familiar with people. Sure, you come to the door and we chat and we rub elbows and we laugh and we slap knees. All that familiar stuff. I was reading about the Druids. Remember the Druids? For hundreds of years, the Druids held sway in Gaul and in Britain and in Ireland. They were people of mystery. They could shapeshift. They could cast spells and move things. People stood in awe of them and listened for their wisdom. No common things here. And I thought to myself, does our familiarity with each other make the great divine mystery just far too familiar? Does it make God small, do you think? We are dealing, after all, with the power that created the world and fashions us and moves as mystery among us all the time. Need we be a bit more distant, a bit more circumspect in our liturgy and in the things we say and do? Well, it gives me something to work on come the 1st of February. "We are chosen, we are royal," says Paul. "We were made for love. We were made to love," says Paul. Treat yourself to your healing. Ask where you are these days. Feel the depth of yourself. Say yes to noble things. Say no to cheap things and see what happens to you. Also, there is a sense of being faithful to something beyond yourself. Did you get up in the morning this morning as faithful to something beyond yourself? I listened yesterday to a sermon preached by James Forbes Jr. I hadn't heard him preach for a while. I looked him up on YouTube, James Forbes Jr. preaching, and he was preaching on the anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. just a couple of years ago on that anniversary. And he said, when Martin Luther King Jr. died, I walked on the same bridge across which he had walked, and I said out loud to his spirit, "Martin, I swear I will not let you have died in vain." And from that day, I have turned my life in that direction. And then he told a story about how far we've come, although we still have far to go. He said, when I was a very young man, they gave us permission in the South to go into Woolworths and buy a hot dog there. Usually, people of color had to stand at the booth outside and order through a window. But the laws had changed, and I had my money and I was going to go in to get a hot dog with mustard and relish and ketchup. And I sat down at the counter to order my hot dog, and the white woman next to me turned and screamed and ran from the room. Forbes said I was not going to rape her, nor was I going to steal her money. I had simply come to get a hot dog with mustard and relish and ketchup. I have no memory as to whether I ever ordered that hot dog, but I remember vividly the woman's panic and the scream as she ran from the room. When I went home beside myself, the only thing I could do was to write a letter to a white woman in our town who had taken several of the colored boys to her school with her to spend time with us and read to us and talk to us. I poured my soul out to that white woman, better than rage, just pouring out my soul. And years later, when I was the senior minister of the Riverside Church in New York, there was a knock on my office door, and that woman, now old, frail, and white-haired, said, "Jim, I've come to give you back your letter and to tell you how marvelously you have handled your life. We've come a long way," he said, "but I said to Martin Luther King Jr. on that day, I shall live for you. Martin, you have not died in vain." And I get up in the morning, and something in me says, Christ died for you. Something in me says, every martyr who stood up against evil for good died for me. And everyone who made good choices as opposed to bad ones and showed me the way died for me. And everyone who laid down a life in the pursuit of peace died for me. And me and my life now has a responsibility for others, a touch of destiny. It is so clear and so true. Young Samuel was asked to say, when he heard the voice speaking in the darkness, "Speak, for your servant is listening." That's the phrase with which to begin a new year. Go out into the darkness of the unknown and say in your quietest voice, "Speak, for your servant is listening." I need to say that out loud in the weeks and the months ahead. It will be brand new ground for me. Speak, for your servant is listening. And you, the members of this great congregation, will need to say it in your childlike voices into the mystery of the air. Speak, for your servant is listening, for there is a great destiny awaiting us all. The preparation we have received is often unseen and often unexpected. All those baby steps, all the joys and sorrows you shared along the way, all those conversations and silences, all towards the touch of destiny, because the touch of destiny is real, and it's delivered by a living God who loves you profoundly. A.A. Milne writes, "Halfway up the stairs isn't up and isn't down. It isn't in the nursery, it isn't in the town. And all sorts of funny thoughts run round my head. It isn't really anywhere. It's somewhere else instead." And from somewhere else, the touch of destiny is coming for you.